expressed concern over the safety of civilians sheltering at hospitals in Gaza as Israel keeps pounding the facilities. More protests are held in the world calling for an end to the Israeli war on Gaza and its brutalities there. And Iran says it has no role in the recent attacks by resistance groups on U.S. forces in West Asia. Hello and welcome, everybody. 35 days and counting since Israel unleashed its onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and civilian areas remain the prime target of the regime's relentless air attacks. In its latest strikes, Israel targeted the Al-Shifa medical complex in Gaza City, killing 13 people. Rights groups have raised concerns about the safety of civilians sheltering at Al-Shifa Hospital. The groups say they found no evidence to prove Tel Aviv's claim that headquarters of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is located under the hospital. Israel has also hit areas near several more hospitals in Gaza in its latest attacks. The regime's onslaught has so far killed nearly 11,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children. Israel is also pressing ahead with its ground invasion in Gaza, forcing mass evacuations. Meanwhile, lawyers representing a large group of Palestinian NGOs have filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court over what they've described as genocide in Gaza.
We build our cases and gradually make our voices heard. We'll talk about it again, but nevertheless, what we saw after a few days made us think that we were moving on. This was no longer just a military operation with its abuses, which would amount to war crimes. We decided that it was beginning to look very much like an act of genocide. And when I say genocide, as detailed in the complaint, that is here and that I have sent to everyone. It's not a philosophy, it's not a thought, it's not even a historical reference. Genocide is what the treaties say and what international case law says.
The World Food Program has raised the alarm about the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. The WFP said all of Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinian inhabitants lack sufficient food and face malnutrition amid Israel's devastating siege of the territory. It added that 33% of Gazans were food insecure before Israel attacked the territory a month ago, and now all of them are food insecure. The administrator of the UN Development Program has also warned of rising poverty in the occupied Palestinian territories.
I think after 1 month of this war now unfolding, first of all, what is quite clear is that on top of the humanitarian crisis that the world has seen unfold in Gaza right now, we also are beginning to see the development crisis that follows, the increase in poverty rates, the loss of GDP, the destruction in terms of infrastructure, housing units. Now, we are obviously just talking about Gaza right now. There is also the West Bank, different conditions, but equally, this is the Palestinian economy, so to speak.
Also, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says it is seeking nearly $500 million for Gaza due to what it called unprecedented devastation in the territory. UNRWA says humanitarian needs in the territory are colossal and grow by the hour due to Israel's siege and brutal war. Israel's repeated threats to the people in Gaza to evacuate their homes have already sparked international criticism. But the regime's relentless bombings of the Palestinian territory have forced tens of thousands of people to flee from northern Gaza to the southern part of the besieged territory. Let's listen to Palestinians recounting the horrors as they left their homes.
We left the area due to the intense bombardment. We had been holding on there for 32 days. Yesterday, we made the decision to leave because the bombing was very intense.
They show no mercy. Among the displaced are young and elderly women, individuals who have lost their legs, and their children who are too exhausted sitting on the ground. Some are carrying their mothers and they are unsure of where to seek refuge.
We've lost our homes. We've lost our children. Where is the global community? Where are our fellow Muslims? Look at us. We are Muslims, just like you. We are not infidels. Where can the people take refuge? They are living in tents, in the streets. We left our homes due to the relentless bombardment. Where can we go now?
Israel's deadly violence is claiming more lives across the occupied West Bank. A 21-year-old Palestinian man has become the latest victim of Israel's crimes in a town east of the West Bank city of Nablus. Laith Mohammad Bakir Nassasser was fatally shot during a late Thursday raid by Israeli forces. His death brought to 19 the number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank in the span of 24 hours, 14 of whom lost their lives in an attack on the city of Jenin and its refugee camp. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry described the attack as a deliberate escalation. At least 182 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since the regime's war on Gaza started on October the 7th. A massive demonstration is taking place once again in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Time and again, we've seen people in their thousands, tens of thousands, show up in the streets of the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, and also in other cities as well, in support of the Palestinian cause, in support of Gazans, and also denouncing the Israeli war and massacre that's being carried out against the besieged Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Our correspondent Yusuf Mauri is joining us now from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, to tell us more about today's demonstrations. Yusuf?
Well, one of the speakers at the podium who was addressing the protesters, he said that the Ansar Allah movement, the head officials, they received a phone call from U.S. officials when the operation against Gaza started by the Israeli regime. And he basically said that the U.S. officials, they warned the Ansar Allah officials not to get involved in what is happening in occupied Palestine. They warned the Ansar Allah movement, the Yemeni army, that if they would get involved, then they would face severe consequences from the U.S. military. And upon receiving that call, Yemen's armed forces received directive from the head military officials to mobilize and to begin installing military ballistic missile attacks pointed at Israel in order to bring an end to the suffering happening in Palestine. So the message that was delivered today is that the Yemeni military is not afraid of these threats directed from the U.S. The Yemeni army and the Yemeni military, they will not bow down to the arrogance of the United States and Western powers, and they will not take too kindly to the threats that the U.S. Biden administration is constantly directing towards the Yemeni army. As was addressed today, the Yemeni army will continue to launch ballistic missiles. They will continue to launch drone strikes towards Israel until a ceasefire is reached or until the Israeli regime ends its continuous genocide on the Palestinian people.
Right, Yusuf, if you may also talk to us about what was announced yesterday by the resistance front in Yemen, as the Ansar Allah forces divulged that they downed a very sophisticated U.S. MQR drone over Yemen. What can you tell us about that and how significant that event was?
So this was a U.S. drone that was approaching Yemeni territorial waters in the Red Sea, and it was making its way to engage in espionage activities over the port city of Hodeidah. And upon entering Yemeni territorial waters, the U.S. drone was shot down by Yemen's air defense system, an air defense system that the U.S. and Saudi-led coalition had no idea was in possession of the Yemeni army, right? And this came as a surprise to many states in the region that Yemen now has a capable aerial defense system that's able to target, U.S. drones flying over the Red Sea at long distance. So I think they're going to think twice about conducting any military operations over Yemeni territorial waters or over the capital Sana'a. As the Yemeni army has mentioned many times, they've spent many years developing their aerial defense system. They spent many years manufacturing domestic ballistic missiles that are able to launch into space and come back down to hit their target. And this was the case a couple of days ago when the Yemeni armed forces, they launched a ballistic missile whereby the Israeli regime countered it, intercepted it, using their space air defense system. So what we can expect going forward is for demonstrations such as the one that we've seen today continue, but we can also expect to see more ballistic missiles and drones targeting deep into occupied Palestine. And as the leader of the revolution here in Yemen has made very clear, these military attacks from Yemen will not discontinue, even if U.S. continues to issue its threats, and even if the U.S. Puts together a coalition force to wage attacks on Yemen, they will never surrender, they will never give up the Palestinian people, and they will not stand idle while Palestinians are being massacred by the Zionist Israeli regime.
Right, thanks a lot, Youssef Wahri, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Moving on, Israeli forces have used a Palestinian man as a human shield during a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khan, also known as Hebron. An online video shows Israeli forces using a handcuffed and blindfolded man as a human shield in Fawar refugee camp. The man is a former prisoner. Israeli forces detained him again before exploding his house. They also beat and dragged him from the house. The soldier then took cover behind the man while aiming his rifle towards an unseen target. The Israeli raid in Al-Khadid resulted in clashes with the Palestinians. Their troops time and again raid different areas in the occupied West Bank, making arrests. Demonstrators have occupied the lobby of the New York Times office in Manhattan, calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Media workers were among the demonstrators. They accused the leading American newspaper of bias towards Israel in the coverage of the Gaza war. Meanwhile, in Brazil, hundreds of protesters burned Israeli and U.S. flags outside the U.S. consulate in Rio de Janeiro. In West Asia, thousands of Lebanese schoolchildren protested in front of the U.N. headquarters in Beirut, denouncing the killing of children in Gaza. In Jordan, hundreds of workers and patients from a cancer center demonstrated in Amman in solidarity with Palestinians. In the Iranian capital, Tehran, demonstrators condemned Israel's indiscriminate massacre of people in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. Also, protesters in the South Korean capital called for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Well, Iran's envoy to the UN says his country has not been involved in recent attacks by resistance groups against U.S. bases in West Asia. Amir Saidi Davani was speaking with CNN. He said Iran has cooperation with resistance groups in the region, but he added the groups conducted those attacks at their own decision and by their own direction. Resistance fighters based in Iraq have, in recent weeks, carried out attacks on U.S. bases in Iraq and the neighboring Syria. They say the attacks are in response to Washington's support for the Israeli regime in its war on Gaza. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has also fired drones and missiles at Israel, and on Wednesday, the movement downed a U.S. spy drone. The U.S. has warned Iran over the developments, arguing that Tehran backs the resistance fighters. France has held an international conference to increase humanitarian assistance to Palestine, but many say too little was produced and far too late. Israel's month-long siege, bombardment, and invasion of Palestine has already created a full-blown humanitarian crisis. Rami Mazri has more on the story.
More than a month after Israel's unprecedented illegal siege of Gaza began, the West has hosted an international conference for humanitarian assistance to Palestine for the first time. Officials from over 50 countries, international agencies, and NGOs gathered in Paris to increase the levels of urgent aid caused by Israel's indiscriminate bombing, the murder of 11,000 Palestinians, and a refusal to allow even the most basic material needs into Gaza.
Severely limiting food, water, and medicine is collective punishment. It took many countries that have championed international justice too long to call for adherence to international humanitarian law. At the same time, several countries rushed to call for cutting aid to Palestine, abruptly unplugging an entire system that depends on international aid to survive.
French President Emmanuel Macron said that pledges amounting to $1 billion were announced, but many in France say that's too little and too late.
In all of our countries, we've shown our governments how we feel. And Obviously, they're never going to respond to it as much as we'd like them to, but there is definitely a shifting consensus, and that's why we're seeing our governments talking about these aid packages. It's important because you can no longer deny what's going on. Over death toll at over 10,000.
The European Union often boasts of being the largest Western aid donor to Palestine, but they have only sent $80 million this year, with $30 million just announced. Contrarily, last year, the United States sent Israel over $3 billion, and they are planning to send them over $14 billion this year. 70% of Gaza's population has been displaced. The healthcare system has been overwhelmed and routinely bombed, while food, water, and fuel are at horrifically low, often non-existent levels. The pledges are the first public attempt of many Western nations to show anything but unconditional support for Tel Aviv.
It breaks my heart when I see what Palestinians are suffering. France must insist that Israel at least allow medicine and humanitarian aid, and this is the very least.
The forum produced widespread accusations that Israel has violated international humanitarian law, and even Macron conceded that Israel cannot fight without rules. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime of Israel keeps bombing hospitals in the Gaza Strip, alleging that Hamas is running secret military operations in a labyrinth of tunnels and underground compounds beneath medical facilities in Gaza. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas has categorically rejected the Israeli claims, saying Israel is hell-bent on hitting hospitals. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNN Cable News Network has covered this story and tells us more. According to a statement from the Palestinian Authority Minister of Health, Mai Al-Kaila, more than 60% of Gaza's hospitals and medical centers are now out of service. Mai Al-Kaila said that 16 of 35 hospitals, as well as 51 of 72 medical centers, are no longer operational due to fuel and medical supply shortages, as well as the Israeli bombardment. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society has also issued an urgent appeal to international health and relief organizations to provide aid and supplies to Gaza, warning about the repercussions of fuel shortages in the Al-Quds hospital that is sheltering thousands of displaced Palestinians. The Red Crescent Society said in a statement on Monday, 6th of November, the hospital's fuel reserves will run out within 48 hours, and life-saving equipment, neonatal incubators and intensive care units will cease to function. This is while the United Nations Security Council, in a private session on Monday, 6th of November, failed to reach a consensus on a draft resolution aimed at halting the ongoing conflict in West Asia. Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Robert Wood, said there is no agreement at this point. The so-called E10, consisting of 10 non-permanent member states of the UN Security Council, has drafted a resolution. However, the United States and the United Kingdom, permanent members of the UN Security Council who possess the power of veto, have opposed it. Western powers, particularly the United States and Britain, are resisting to include language in the resolution that calls for an immediate ceasefire, a proposition supported by several other council members. Robert Wood said there have been discussions about humanitarian pauses and we're interested in pursuing language on that score. But he added there was disagreement within the Security Council on whether that would be acceptable. Meanwhile, China's UN ambassador, Jun Zhang, echoed the sentiments expressed by United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, emphasizing that Gaza is a graveyard for Palestinian children. Jun Zhang called for an urgent ceasefire to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters, "We must act now to find a way out of this brutal, awful, agonizing dead end of destruction. Gaza is becoming a graveyard for Palestinian children. Hundreds of girls and boys are reportedly being massacred or injured every day." China's United Nations ambassador Jun Zhang said, "As we speak, Palestinian civilians continue to be massacred. Children are bearing the brunt, as several US officials have also admitted already. Gaza is becoming a graveyard for children. No one is safe in Gaza." The United Arab Emirates emphasized the importance of upholding the rules of warfare. United Arab Emirates Ambassador Lana Zaki Nusseibeh, who co-initiated the meeting with China, underlined that discussions within the UN Security Council were ongoing and nations were working to bridge their differences. Nusseibeh said, "We condemn the indiscriminate attacks by Israel on the Gaza Strip, the massacring and maiming of children, attacks on schools and hospitals in Gaza, and denying children access to humanitarian assistance are all very grave violations against them." During the meeting, United Nations humanitarian officials briefed the UN Security Council on the dire humanitarian situation in the region. Previous attempts to pass resolutions in the Security Council have faced challenges, including two US vetoes, further underscoring the complexity of reaching a consensus on this critical issue. Shortages of food, water and medical supplies have worsened since the Israeli regime tightened its blockade on Gaza and began bombarding the enclave after Hamas's October 7th operation against the occupying regime. The Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. Palestinian Health Minister Mai Al-Kaila announced on Sunday, 5th of November, since the start of the Israeli attacks on Gaza, hundreds of medical personnel and civil defense workers have been martyred in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Minister also said during the same period 16 out of 35 Gaza hospitals and 51 out of 72 Gaza clinics have gone out of service due to Israeli bombing or lack of fuel and medical supplies. Numerous incidents have been recorded of medical facilities such as Al-Ahli Arab Hospital and ambulances being hit by Israeli air raids, martyring patients as well as medical workers. Earlier, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, Francesca Albanese, described the collapse of the health system in Gaza as a catastrophe. Francesca Albanese said, "Israel is not fighting another country, but a people in an occupied land." The comments come as the United Nations aid agency in the Palestinian territories, UNRWA, reported that it has not been able to contact its team in Gaza after Israel imposed another communication blackout on the besieged enclave. The Tel Aviv regime has also blocked water, food and electricity to Gaza, plunging the territory into a humanitarian crisis. The health ministry in Gaza has said Israel is waging a frenzied war on hospitals in the besieged enclave. A spokesman for the Palestinian health ministry, Ashraf Al-Qatara, cited the Israeli attack on Nasser Medical Complex on Sunday, 5th of November, which martyred tens of Palestinians. Ashraf Al-Qatara said on Monday, 6th of November, the occupation is waging a frenzied war on hospitals and ambulances in the Gaza Strip and has directly targeted the only mental health hospital in the Gaza Strip and the Rantisi Specialized Hospital for Children. The Nasser Medical Complex comprises the Al-Nasser Children's Hospital, the Rantisi Specialized Hospital, the Eye Hospital, and the Psychiatric Hospital. Al-Qatara said hundreds of displaced people who sought refuge in the hospitals as well as patients in the oncology center were injured in the Israeli airstrikes. He added, "The health system has become completely incapable as the aggression enters its second month." Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story and tells us more. In a recent statement, the World Health Organization, WHO, condemned the Zionist regime's attacks on hospitals in the Gaza Strip and reiterated the urgent need to protect all health workers, patients, health transport and health facilities. The World Health Organization, WHO, said in a statement, "Attacks on healthcare, including the targeting of hospitals and restricting the delivery of essential aid such as medical supplies, fuel and water, may amount to violations of international humanitarian law. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip that have been reeling under the Israeli bombardment is treating thousands of patients, including those in intensive care units and children in incubators. Thousands of internally displaced civilians have also sought refuge in Gaza hospitals after being forced to leave their homes." The Israeli regime keeps pounding hospitals, alleging that Hamas is running a secret military operations in a labyrinth of tunnels and underground compounds beneath medical facilities in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, in a statement, has categorically rejected the Israeli claims, saying the Israeli regime is hell-bent on bombing hospitals in Gaza. The Hamas statement called for the formation of a United Nations International Committee to inspect hospitals in Gaza to disprove Israel's unfounded claims. It said the Israeli regime is only trying to justify and cover up its crimes against innocent civilians.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio,
Now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
We come to the next topic for tonight, which is how do we cultivate a strong Muslim identity in ourselves as parents, as caregivers, and most importantly, for our next generation. You know, whatever we do in our life, you know, especially for those who are parents who have children, we recognize that we live for our children. Right? When you get to be 30, 40, 50, you have children, you have grandchildren, you recognize that at a point in your life that my time is coming up. I mean, only Allah knows when we will leave this world, but we tend to recognize that the older we get, the more white hairs that we see, the more closer we are to death. You know, in fact, when Nabi Ibrahim, may God's peace and blessings be upon him, Prophet Abraham, when death was approaching him, he asked Allah, right, through a conversation that he had maybe with the angel or with Allah in some means, he said to Allah, he says, "Ya Allah, I know that death is going to come upon everyone, but why didn't you send me a hint, an indication, some message that would allow me to realize that my death was near?" And what did Allah reply to Ibrahim, peace be upon him? He says, "Ibrahim, don't you see the white hairs in your beard, in your head? These white hairs are a symbol that your time was coming closer." Right? So when we get to that age, brothers and sisters, we recognize that our life is drawing to a close, but that our next generation, many of them that I see with us here tonight, that they will be the torchbearers of this religion as we move on. In fact, there is a beautiful hadith that comes to us from our second Imam, Imam Hassan ibn Ali al-Mujtaba, alayhi salatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. In which, although in the hadith it says that he called his children and he called his brother's children, meaning the children of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, into his company, into his presence, but we can, and scholars have inferred that this is a universal message of Imam al-Hassan, peace be upon him, to all of us. He calls the children near him and he says to them something very profound that I think we have to also reflect upon tonight. He says to the children, he says that indeed you are the young children. You are the young children of our family, of our community. And he says, undoubtedly in the future you will become the leaders of your community. So he says, فَتَعَلَّمُوا الْإِلْمِ, go and seek knowledge. And he tells them, if you can't memorize all you that you learn, you go to school, you learn, but you can't take it all in and memorize it. He says, write it down and safeguard it, because in the future you will need that. It's a very profound way that the Imam was speaking, recognizing that these same children that are playing, that are running around, that are having fun, even in the month of Muharram, if they're running around and causing a so-called disturbance, I would rather have them be running around in here in the majlis than running outside in the playground or in the park, not hearing anything of the words of the Quran or the ziyarat of the Ashura, for example. So we have to recognize that our children, they're young today, they're innocent, they don't have responsibility. Their only responsibility, you know, from age 0 to 7 is to have fun, is to learn the mechanics of this world, what happens, how do things run. But even in that, they get to learn lessons. And we recognize that when we are 6 feet under, when we're buried in our graves, these same children that are running around having fun today, they'll be the presidents, the treasurers, the program organizers, the leaders of our community. And so we have to give them that focus. And that's why the topic for tonight, as I said, is how do we cultivate that identity in our next generation? Let me mention the verse, the translation, and just some of the opinions of our commentators of what the verse may mean. So in this verse, chapter 41, verse 33, Allah says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَمَنْ أَحْسَنُ قَوْلًا مِمَّنْ دَعَى إِلَى اللَّهِ وَأَمِلَ صَالِحًا وَقَالَ إِنَّنِي مِنَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ. Allah says, and who is better in speech than one who invites to God, who does righteous actions and says, indeed, I am of the Muslims. I am one of the believers. So the last part of the verse says, وَقَالَ إِنَّنِي مِنَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ, that indeed, I say that I am of the believers. Ayatollah Nasir Makarem in his Tafsir Namuna, he says this phrase, وَقَالَ إِنَّنِي مِنَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ, could have one of two meanings. He says this, قَال, to speak, to say. He says it could also mean I believe. So he says it could just be an inner belief. Somebody calls towards Allah and they truly believe that they are of the believers, that they have submitted to God. But he says another option, another meaning of this word is the actual statement that I go out and proclaim. And if we look at it in that way, then I would take it to mean that I'm not scared as a Muslim to tell people that I am a Muslim. You know, there was a time in the world after September 11th that we were scared to identify as Muslims, for many of us. Right? I remember when that attack happened and I was at work at a Muslim organization, and I remember the Twin Towers were hit and we ended up locking the doors of the center immediately, and we started getting calls both in support for us, because somehow the American government knew instantaneously that Muslims or so-called Muslims were involved. And so we got hate calls, we got calls of support and care and concern. But there was a real fear in the community. Sisters were concerned because they are the most visible within our community because of the hijab. Men were concerned because we had beards, although many other communities have beards, but we were concerned at a different level. And, you know, when we look at what happened, and not only that event, but many other things that have happened over the years, I'm not going to say because we didn't have, you know, conviction in Allah and we didn't have that iman and we didn't have that identity, but we definitely were perhaps having some level of shortcomings in identifying as Muslims or in letting people know who we are, because we had done very little, if no outreach up until that point. We didn't invite people to our centers. We didn't have interfaith gatherings at that level where we could invite the community to meet us and to understand and know who we are. And obviously now in, 22 years after the fact, 21 years after, we have developed a bit more of that ability to outreach and to let people know who we are. But we still have obviously a long way to go that we can proudly proclaim that we are Muslims, as this verse says, وَقَالَ إِنَّنِي مِنَ الْمُسْلِمِينَ. We still have a ways to go to be able to proclaim our Islam, to let people know that we follow this religion and this is what our teachings entail. And this is something that the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, try to inculcate within their teachings to us every step of the way. They might not have said it verbally, to develop a Muslim identity, to create an Islamic culture, because even that is a term which is up for discussion. What does it mean to have an Islamic culture? Right? Culture is such a vast term. Culture includes the food that we eat, the clothing that we wear, the art that we engage in, the music that we listen to or create. Halal music, obviously, not the haram style. But culture is very vast.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صل عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Thank you.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey has found UK's poorest families have endured a frightening collapse in their living standards over the past year as a result of soaring energy and food prices, with nearly two-thirds experiencing extreme levels of poverty. We take a look at some of the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. Ahead of a visit to the United Kingdom in the coming days, when the United Nations Poverty Envoy will urge British ministers to increase welfare spending, he said poverty levels in this country are simply not acceptable and the government is violating international laws. Olivier de Schutter, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, cited research showing universal credit payments of £85 a week for single adults over the age of 25 were grossly insufficient, and described the UK's main welfare system as a leaking bucket. In an interview with The Guardian 5 years after his predecessor, Philip Alston, angered the Conservative government by charging it with the systematic humiliation of a significant part of the British population, the Belgian lawyer risked a fresh confrontation by saying things have got worse. The government hit back, claiming that it had not broken international laws, that absolute poverty had fallen since the Conservatives took power, and that it was helping thousands of people into jobs. Olivier de Schutter said, "It's simply not acceptable that we have more than a fifth of the population in a rich country such as the United Kingdom at risk of poverty today," referring to government data showing that 14.4 million people lived in relative poverty in 2021-2022, a million more than the previous year. Olivier de Schutter added, "The policies in place are not working or not protecting people in poverty, and much more needs to be done for these people to be protected." De Schutter said the United Kingdom had signed an international covenant that created a duty to provide a level of social protection which ensured an adequate standard of living, but that it was being broken, with welfare payments falling behind costs of the poorest people. He added, "If you look at the price of housing, electricity, the very high levels of inflation for food items over the past couple of years, I believe that the £85 a week for adults is too low to protect people from poverty, and this is in violation of the Article 9 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. That is what human rights law says." He said increasing universal credit would be the single most important step that the United Kingdom could meet towards meeting its international obligations. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, in 2022, 3.8 million British people experienced destitution, struggling to afford to meet their most basic physical needs to stay warm, dry, clean and fed. This included about 1 million British children. It was almost 2.5 times the number of people in 2017. A British government spokesperson claimed, "We are committed to protecting the most vulnerable and in 2021-2022, there were 1.7 million fewer people in absolute poverty after housing costs than in 2009-2010. Households are at least £6,000 a year better off in full-time work than out of work on benefits, and since 2010, there are almost 700,000 fewer children growing up in workless households, transforming their life chances. Absolute poverty is fixed in real terms, while relative poverty measures household incomes below 60% of the median average in that year. The government spokesperson claimed to help more people out of poverty through work, we're investing £3.5 billion to help thousands into jobs and grow the economy as we bear down on inflation, and we are committed to increasing the national living wage. Olivier de Schutter, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, said the United Kingdom was not alone among developed nations in sliding back on how it tackles poverty. He added, "One common realization is that we need to stop thinking that economic growth will lift all boats. We've seen in most OECD countries that growth of gross domestic product, GDP, has been going hand in hand with increasing inequalities and a failure to reduce levels of both relative and absolute poverty." The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, is an intergovernmental organization with 38 member countries founded in 1961 to stimulate economic progress and world trade. Olivier de Schutter said, "So we should stop focusing on creating the macroeconomic conditions that will stimulate growth and focus instead on providing support to low-income households, providing access to work for all people, including people who have low levels of qualification, and creating a much more inclusive economy rather than one that creates wealth for the elites and particularly for the shareholders of the largest corporations." Olivier de Schutter's remarks follow Philip Alston's damning report into poverty in the United Kingdom, which he published after a two-week research visit in 2018. Philip Alston, an internationally respected human rights lawyer, said, "Much of the glue that has held British society together since the Second World War has been deliberately removed and replaced with a harsh and uncaring ethos." Olivier de Schutter said, "The warning signals that Philip Alston gave 5 years ago were not acted upon. There's a huge gap, which is increasingly troubling, between the kinds of indicators the government chooses to assess its progress on the one hand, and the lived experience of people living in poverty on the other." The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. A survey has found Britain's poorest families have endured a frightening collapse in their living standards over the past year as a result of soaring energy and food prices, with nearly two-thirds experiencing extreme levels of poverty. The annual survey of frontline poverty and social services professionals by Buttle UK charity reported unparalleled concern about the prevalence and consequences of hunger and mental illness in struggling and vulnerable families affected by the rising cost of living. The charity said this year's survey had received some of the most distressing accounts of children in need it had ever seen. "We are talking not just about significant hardship, but life-changing and life-limiting deep poverty," one respondent, noting the parallel neglect and domestic chaos endured by a child she visited once a week for emotional well-being sessions, reported the child had no shoes that fitted her, was frequently excluded from school, and had been caught stealing an apple. The respondent added, "She has no friends in school and no outside interests. She spends her time in a cold, dark house. When I read this back, it sounds like a story from the 1800s. It's unbelievable that in the United Kingdom, in 2023, there are children living like this." Respondents to the survey reported that more than half of the families they work with had been unable to afford food, heating, rent, or online access, with just under half going without basic domestic appliances. Nearly two-thirds had used food banks. Another respondent wrote, "They worked with a child who lives in the cold, dark house due to their parents being unable to afford to heat or light their home. A child that does not want to go to school because they're worried about their parents' physical and mental well-being. A child isolated from friends as they cannot afford to attend their friends' birthday parties, as their parents cannot afford a small present for the birthday party." Poverty campaigners, teachers and frontline welfare workers have expressed growing alarm about the damaging effects of destitution, particularly on children, including physical ill health, undernourishment, mental illness, social isolation, school absences, and poor classroom behavior. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with President Raisi and his cabinet on August 30, 2023, on the occasion of Government Week. I would like to mention a few more things. First, maintain your contact with the people. This is very valuable. It is very good to have close, friendly relations with people, to speak to them humbly in person, to interact with them, to go inside their houses and to sit on their rugs. Don't stop doing this. This is a good opportunity. Second, continue communicating with the intellectual elites as much as you can. This is very valuable. The elites have opinions, they have plans, they give good recommendations, and they come up with useful ideas. Be sure to communicate with these people. Different sections should pursue the elites and follow up on their ideas. Another point is to have presence in the universities, which is necessary. Be present among the students and professors, listen to what they have to say, and inform them of necessary matters. They are unaware of many things. Yes, they may be students, professors, intellectuals, and aware of certain things, but there are also many things that they are unaware of.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They see some things during the Passengers of Progress tours, program that takes the students to see firsthand the progress that has been made in the country that have been set up. There are new and interesting things for all of them there. Many things have been accomplished in our country, but our students don't know about them. They are surprised when they see these things, and so are the professors. I once said that we need to set up a tour to show some people the country's defense facilities. I would now like to add that such tours should be set up for all the advancements that have been made in the country. Our elites should go see these things from up close and be informed. This is something that helps greatly in confronting the enemy's belligerence. One of the places of the enemy's belligerence is in the universities, and it has placed hopes in this. Your presence in the universities will neutralize that. Another point and recommendation is to make the government's use of media more effective, which I mentioned before as well.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.